Well, let's get back to things that don't make sense.
I think they make more sense.
Yeah, really.
Well, but that's why all these things in the world don't make sense.
It's true. We're really talking about the pleroma in daily life. Mutually contradictory acts that no one recognizes, and if you do, you will get shot.
You get shot down like you were.
You get shot down. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, as I said, there. This was published separately. I just wanted to give us a sense of how Jung was trying to work out the role of Abraxas, because Abraxas is going to play so much of a part in the Seven Sermons. Is everybody okay so far? No. Well, no. We'll keep coming back to these ideas, by the way. Yeah, this is just... So, he goes on. So we got Eros, world creator. We've got above. We've got Abraxas, world creator below. And then you've got a tree coming out of that part of the mandala. And you've got fire coming out of that part of the mandala. Those two images are related, and these two images are related. We could try to interpret him, but I don't even know if he's important to do that. Just so you get a portrait of how he's trying to visualize Abraxas as one, here as one component. One creative component because of the tree. You've got a winged serpent and a winged mouse up here, and he calls the winged mouse a hole digging activity, which I would take to mean going deeper. I'm trying to think, where can we skip just to... down here you've got a larva and a... He calls this a devilish monster. I think that's probably enough. Just so you get a portrait of how he is trying to circle around this idea of a praxis, which he will then pick up in the Seven Sermons. That's really the point of this. It's so complicated, I don't even know if it's worth trying to interpret. It would probably leave us more confused than anything. There are other elements, but that's the juxtaposition he stresses.
Oh, there is a feminine in here. It's a fire.
Mm-hmm. Let's see.
On the column 2, about midway down.
Right, the dove of the Holy Ghost takes wing. Now, which one was that thing?
Where is it on the mandolin?
It's on the right, yeah. Oh, there. I think that's it. Oh, no.
Okay.
You know, we've got, so, again, just to be...
And wisdom, Sophia pours from a double beaker to the left. The feminine sphere is that of heaven. Mm-hmm. I guess that's that other, opposite that.
Where do you think that is? Here? No. Yeah, it's totally confusing.
Yeah. But anyway, just my whole thing was that the feminine is included. In
right. I had ignored that.
Because this whole mandala is supposed to be representing, is supposed to be a picture of the components of Abraxas?
No, okay. Of the world, I
of
would
the
say.
World.
Yeah, and Abraxas is one part of it.
Okay. So this.
When did he do this? Did we do?
says here, well, it was published in 1955. I don't know when he did it.
Okay, well then, erase what I said about feminine being.
Why? No, you're right. I guess this must be a beaker here. Does he say to the left, the servants?
Don't the beaker to left and right.
Well, the double beaker would be...
It's here. It's got two...
Yeah.
It's got two cups. Here.
Yeah.
You can't see it here, but you can see it in the...
Right. Well, that's all. Both Appendix C and this one are just anticipating what we're going to see in the seven sermons. So if you're happy with just that, just... not to worry about all the details of that mandala, just so that we've gotten some feeling of what Abraxas is. That's the point of going into it. So we'll go back now to where we departed, which was on page 345. So we're at bracket 6. I did as my soul advised, informed in matter of the thoughts that you gave me. That will be what's coming up. Although that may mean more than that. But forming the thoughts in matter would be starting to write down the seven sermons which contain seeds of his later ideas. And I think the basic theme is the theme of the opposites.
Looks like footnote 72 says that the Mongol was done around, I don't know if it was done the whole thing, but the January 16th, 1960.
Oh, well, thanks for bringing that.
Yeah, but that's Appendix C.
Oh.
Oh, maybe, well, maybe you're right. Seems to refer to the composition of the Systema Mundi, whatever that is, Appendix A. So I guess it was done early and then published later.
Mm-hmm. Probably worked on for years and years, but maybe,
yeah.
The start of it. As we put things in.
Did you say writing in is joining matter and spirit?
I would, yeah. Put it, as I understand it, basically, it's taking his ideas and putting them on paper. And then taking that paper and applying it to his analytic methods. But here I think, forming my thoughts in matter is the writing of the seven sermons.
So if you write a poem, you aren't really joining spirit and matter.
You aren't?
You are.
Yeah. I think particularly if you then turn around and say, what's the poem trying to teach me? That your idea has a real effect on the physical world.
So not a poem that you're trying to write for anyone else.
Could be. Just whatever your, if you can take your thoughts, your prose thoughts or your poetic thoughts, whatever, and realize how important they are, to record them and then to let them have an effect on you. That is how I would understand formed in matter.
Otherwise, they're simply like dreams.
Right.
But in that whole act, you are joining spirit and matter.
Right.
A dream by itself is not doing the job.
Right.
It's got the matter, but you haven't given it form using consciousness.
Mm-hmm. But I think the important thing to realize how this whole book that we've done was to get us to this point where he's now writing the foundation of his psychology. It's in a highly imaginative, intuitive way, but it's the foundation of his psychology. And he couldn't do that until the anima was transformed. And pretty soon we'll see in Philemon. Remember, we always had the old man and the young woman. Here the young woman's being transformed. Pretty soon we'll see Philemon being transformed. So that original duality, we went back and forth, back and forth, back and forth, is now starting to get somewhere. But it took him, 3 years.
And then he's also going back to the dead to try to transform there.
Well.
In their malformed, their ideas that haven't been carried forward.
That's part of putting the thoughts in matter.
Bringing forward, in other words, what's left undone from the past.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. Well, then we have the reference to fire. One night she suddenly came to me with a sense of unease and anxiety, explained, "What am I seeing? What does the future harbor? Blazing fire? A fire hovers in the air. It draws near. A flame, many flames, a searing miracle. How many lights burn? My beloved, it is the mercy of the eternal fire. The breath of fire descends on you." But I cried out in horror. I fear something terrible and dreadful. I am deeply afraid. Since everything that you announced beforehand were awful, must everything be broken, burned, and destroyed. So, fire, I would take to mean, on the one hand, World War I. The fire in him as well for eroticism. And the fact that there's a symmetry between those two fires. And what those fires do is destroy the old.
Would you say from the eroticism would come, so maybe from those two would come Eros then?
Yeah, Eros and creativity. But I think it's driving home to him what we've already said. How World War I was such a transition in Western thinking. Prior to that, the world was getting better, and we were having railroads and telephones, and then kaboom. The idea of linear progress, of the effectiveness of morality, It just vanished. The importance of the church just vanished. And that's part of what's being destroyed. And what he is offering is an attempt to replace that. But he's got to go through the destruction himself.
So could you say that those the people in Zurich are going through this erotic eroticism?
Yes.
Thinking they're already to Eros.
Yeah, they're, you could say they're living out of Abraxas, rather than taking Abraxas as the starting point to transform. Really, you know, they're back in 1920, where the task was to recover sexuality, thinking that was the answer, rather than the means whereby.
Or are they just indulging in Roman hedonism?
Yeah.
The degeneration of that discovery.
Exactly, yeah. But I think when that discovery does manifest, it does come on in a degenerate way, because it has been so neglected.
The transformation of the anima that you were referring to earlier is that she is willing not to be subservient to Jung's reason.
And contribute to Jung's reason.
Contribute to Jung's reason.
As opposed just to making every skirt look attractive.
And to confuse him and create chaos.
I was trying to think after you told that story Saturday, as I was trying to sort that out in my mind, where, you know, when do you live out the shadow? When is it important to do that, as it was for Jung with Tony Wolf? And when is it important to not? And what I came up with was the people that you were dealing with, they were not struggling. If you are having a conflict that is conscious, you're struggling. You're feeling that ripping apart. They're not feeling that.
No.
They're
These people are concerned.
Yeah,
there's something breaking.
Right. If you have a conflict that's conscious, it's you're just thinking about it all the time. You can't.
You're suffering.
You're being crucified. Whereas an unconscious conflict, you're just going about that's your happy carrot.
Yeah, that you're just
destroying everybody in your path.
Yeah.
Creating conscious conflicts in some of them. But that's the destructive, that's, you know, it moves forward when it finally hits somebody who's conscious. Or makes it conscious.
Yeah. I think part of it, the answer too, would have to be historical. I don't think sexuality is a big deal anymore. I mean, it's a sport. But I don't know if we realize what sexuality was at the turn of the century. I remember when I was in Zurich hearing a story of a northern Italian village in which the girl, a young girl, 15, 16, walked home from school holding her boyfriend's hand. She was declared a whore. She had to leave the village. That's the context of Jung's wrestling with sexuality. We have another problem now. That sexuality was so demonized that, which is not anymore. I mean, at least in our Western urban world.
Well, at least not for most people. That would be a very rare.
I mean, maybe in, say, certain Muslim countries and so on. But So the task now is a different one. So I would just add history to what you said.
Task now would be to give the erotic meaning.
Yeah, and to allow the erotic to turn into eros. Real relationship, real caring, real giving, supporting.
Which in itself is a creative act.
Right.
If I think of it.
Yeah, that is our task. The world's gotten so cold. And I've seen dream after dream of like snowstorms and ice storms and hailstorms. That's the nature of our time. It's just cold. Sex, remember Jung talks, I think the phrase is with Christiane and Morgan, the fire gives heat but not light. So it's not leading to understanding. It's leading to passion, but once the passion is over. Next. Okay, so that's the fire. She says she wants his fear. A little farther down. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. Whoops. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 lines up. I also want your fear. Which I take to mean recognizing the danger of this enterprise. And why does he need the fear? To bring it before the ruler of this world. He demands the sacrifice of your fear. He appreciates your sacrifice. He has mercy upon you. So that ruler of the world, of course, is Abraxas. That what he's going to have to start dealing with is this Abraxas experience. Which I think it's fair to say, at least as I try to understand it, that's the prima materia. We don't have the alchemical language yet, but that's what would be how it would be described later. Now,
and then he says he demands the sacrifice of your fear. In other words, he demands that you give that up to go forward and act.
Yes. Well, Jane, it's again not totally clear to me, but. Yes. How I would make sense of it is you have to have fear in knowing what you're dealing with, but you can't let that fear stop you from dealing with it. You can't be flippant about this, but you also can't shirk from it.
So you sacrifice it to
advise you
to overcome.
You won't let your fear of all these strong emotions stop you from dealing with them.
So it represents what Aaron was talking about, the people wrestling with their conflicts.
Yeah, and wrestling with these opposites.
Involved.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Kim Bob Dylan. If you're going to break the law, you've got to be honest. It just
fits.
Yeah.
It does fit.
Yeah.
Because you can see implied in that is a fear, but a fear overcome. If you didn't have any fear, you'd just break the law, period.
And so the criminal, we're talking about the criminal at one point in time, criminal is the break, well, I guess it's from revision. The criminal is the one who breaks traditions and breaks the law.
But knowing, you could say doing so with awareness of what's at stake.
Doing it consciously, and then Abraxas will have mercy on us.
Then Abraxas will be a starting point. That's how I get it. This is hard. And then Yun says, I just want to be left alone.
Take this cup from me.
Yep. And then the soul said, you possess the word that should not be allowed to remain concealed. Which I would take to mean that something in him knows the importance of the work that will be done. The thing so far, does that make sense? And then more on the fire. I see the surface of the earth and smoke sweeps over it. Again, I think we could take that literally as the war. We could take it metaphorically as the destruction of collective values. We could take it as his own emotional storms. We could take it as what he's going through is vaporizing his Victorian morality.
And what did you just reference there?
The fire. She looked straight into the distance about halfway down on the second column on 364. Sorry, first column.
I see
a
fire.
Yeah, but she looked straight. I see the surface of the earth and smoke sweeps over it. See where I am?
Mm-hmm.
See a fire rolls, yeah. And then which fire there at the very bottom of the first column, the fires that blaze over your head. Look up, the sky's reddened. I feel pretty certain that's World War I. But not only. World War I is fact and metaphor on a personal and collective level. Then in that context, the dark ones appear. Who are the dead? Yeah, column two.
Dark crowd.
Fourth line down, dark crowd. We'll see that they're the dead.
And that refers to the event that he describes in memories, dreams, and reflections, where the crowd seemed to come to the door of his house, right?
Was that in memories?
I don't follow that.
The one I remember from memories is the one where blood runs all over Europe.
Yeah, but there's one where
you have a look.
His children couldn't sleep. They were hearing noises in the house, and everything seemed to be...
Could very well be, Carl. Yeah.
And that would have been, what year was that back?
I think that was Christmas 1913.
1913, mm-hmm. Right. And now he's writing this later, 1916 or so, right?
Well, it's all right around
World War I. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And the dream which I referenced in there, Carl, there's a book for it, where he, remember the dream where he descends in his house, keeps going down and down and down and down and down, and he goes to the Middle Ages, and then he finally comes to some skeletons. That, I think, would be the dead as well. And we saw them earlier, page 294. Remember, he was reading Thomas a Kempis, the Imitation of Christ, and he thinks, this is nuts. I'm not going to imitate Christ. He's about ready to throw out Christianity. And then the dead appear coming back from Jerusalem, where they hadn't found what they were looking for. It's the same dead. And that established how they're tied with the Christian tradition, that the unanswered questions left by Christianity. Here again they say, we have come back from Jerusalem where we did not find what we sought. We implore you to let us in. You have what we desire, not your blood, but your light. That is it. So Philemon then, starts talking to the dead. You want to put that in more logical language. This is the message to the unanswered questions left unanswered by Christianity. And let's see. This is a couple of footnotes which confirm. Footnote 78. On the significance of the sermons that follow, see where I am? Jung said to Aniele Jaffe that the discussions with the dead formed the prelude to what he would subsequently communicate to the world. That's kind of what I was saying earlier. And that the contents anticipated his later books. From that time on, the dead have become ever more distinct for me as the voices of the unanswered, unresolved, and unredeemed. The questions he was required to answer did not come from the world, but from the dead. Yeah, that would be one place those questions came to him. And another footnote, which is, I think, worth looking at, footnote 80. After the first sentence, concerning the relation of Philemon to the sermons, Jung told Aniele Jaffe that he grasped Philemon in the sermons. It was here that Philemon lost his autonomy.
So he saw already was embarked on this then when he had this vision of the horn coming from Jerusalem. Wherever I read this, maybe it was, did he publish them separately? And
yes.
And I think at one point I read that he it's the only thing he regretted publishing. For some reason he felt he shouldn't have published it separately.
Yeah.
But I don't know why.
Well, it's in here. Just happen to have it, Carl.
Okay. but maybe it was in the introduction to that, but where he said that this, apparently these phantoms have been lurking around the house and disturbing his children and everybody. And then when he finally went to the door and opened it and confronted them and then started writing this, and after, and it all came out in one gusher of vision, then everything quieted down in the house. Sorry, I didn't mean to.
No. Actually, what you said is just what I was going to say. He regretted publishing it because he thought it was too personal.
Maybe, and yet he puts it in the Red Book, so maybe that's where he felt it should be.
Yeah.
Its proper place should be.
Yeah.
He thought it was too personal, or
that
people weren't ready for it yet?
Maybe both. I mean, unless you look how hard we're working on it, we've read this whole book beforehand, you can imagine the average person looks at it and just thinks it's gobbledygook. So I think in that sense, he thought, I should have been a little more cautious.
Yeah, it's like, personal in the sense that he revealed himself to naked or something.
Yeah, exactly.
Before the crowd.
Exactly.
Maybe that's why it's in the scrutinies toward the end.
Right. The other thing I wanted just to draw your attention to is how we have two images of resolution. Remember, the anima starts to listen, and he establishes a relationship with Philemon, and they both occur together, more or less together, because that pair had existed as a problem back and forth all along.
Not quite serving him the way that you're now doing.
Right.
Philemon was kind of an imperious old wise man or something. And
aloof.
Wasn't his own personal guide.
That's right.
Comes.
Yeah, you got it. So you can see, we have finally, after 17 years with this material, we have actually gotten somewhere.
17, damn.
Wow. I was joking. But it's been a long journey, but this is where we've come to. And it really was heading somewhere.
Did you see that the same thing for me? The fact that all those relationships are there.
Well, I would say the synchronicity is in the fact that this material is coming up just as the West desperately needs it. That's more, I would say, in synchronicity. And apropos of that kind of synchronicity, the other thing I think is amazing, that the, let me get my text straight. The Dead Sea Scrolls, are they the Gnostic ones, right? That was discovered the same year that we bombed Hiroshima and Nagasaki. Was it 46?
45.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Remember?
Dead Sea Scrolls, I think, were right around 45.
Yeah. So, I would say that the two big crises of our time were World War One and the nuclear atomic explosions. And in both moments, a text appeared, which contains what we need to understand to survive. Jung's for World War One, and the Gnostic texts, in which Sophia plays a big role.
And what about those texts that were discovered in the desert, Nag, whatever it is?
Or I think it was Nag Hammadi. That's the Gnostic scrolls. That was discovered the same year as we bombed Hiroshima and Nagasaki. The Dead Sea Scrolls, I believe, are more Gospel of Thomas and additions to the canon.
That might have been a little later.
That might have been 48. But anyway, I just think it's astounding. Speaking of synchronicity, if this stuff would occur, it's just what we need to hear.
And when did they declare the assumption of Mary in heaven? No one knows that. Doesn't that?
Early 50s.
Maybe he really thought that was significant.
Yeah, because it honors the feminine. And the feminine as materiality. Well, one last point. He says the seven sermons of the dead were written by Basilides. That's footnote 81. He was a 4th century Gnostic. And maybe I won't get into what he's all about now, but we'll pick up with that next time. We'll just spend about 5 minutes on it. I think we've done enough for one day. This is tough stuff. So what we've come up to now is we're going to start hearing, again, I think it's so important, the prelude to what he would communicate to the world. That's why it's worth going into this stuff. It will be a highly symbolic, intuitive, complicated language. I didn't have so much trouble with Sermon 1. I got stuck on Sermon 2. So maybe we can work on that together. I found Sermon 2 very difficult. Sermon 2, it doesn't really say it, but it starts with page 348, second column. Oh, it does say second sermon, yeah. God is dead.
Each one is numbered.
Yeah. So, I don't know whether we'll get farther than that. Did you read it? How far did I have you read it? Sermon 2?
49.
Yeah.
Yeah, at 349 afterwards. Down at the bottom is when it goes into the...
I don't think we'll get this far, but why don't you read over to Sermon, right before Sermon 4 on 351. It says... where it says bracket 9. I don't think we'll get that far. But we probably won't get any farther than 2. And don't be shy about coming up with your own point of view on Sermon 2, because I am stumped. So, Sermon 1, I think I have some idea, but still I appreciate your input. Because, you know, this is difficult, and there's no way one can say this interpretation is right, this interpretation is wrong. Come up with your own point of view, and we'll hash it out together. I'll present my idea, but then I would encourage you to present yours. So I'll say we got as far as... Basilides. and then we'll begin now here. I begin with nothingness.
So it more or less takes over the role of the weapons, right?
Yes. Yeah. Well, yeah. I think Basilides is the author, and then Basilides uses Philemon as the voice. Basilides was a real figure. And I'll read some things about him. Okay. It's not that important, but it's kind of interesting to know who these guys are. He was an early Christian Gnostic, Christian/Gnostic. Well, welcome back.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Good to be back.
See you.
Welcome. No, I'm sorry. I took it for me. Jane, I think.
Oh, okay.
Was that the one I was using to sign?
Didn't have it.
Never returned it. Sorry, Jane.
No, I think you returned it to me, and I'm like,
Thank you.
Okay.
Yeah.
Back
from
Indy, I'm glad I'm back too.
Back among folk. Good folk.
Good folk.
You're all losers.
Yep.